Mitchell Kasorkas, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for joining me. No, Mike Corcoran, I should say.
The pleasure is all mine.
it's cool to talk to you. We were chatting a little before we started here, and like, I should just say, for this could be an unusual episode in that you and I were definitely like pretty good friends like during our time at ILM, and I've told people in the past, I've told my wife this, like, I don't think I've ever met someone funnier than you, man. You've always made me laugh a motherfucker. Like a mofo.
Hey, it's right back at you, man. It's like some of the best laughs I've had in my entire lifetime were with you.
Yeah, for some reason, I think we maybe share a similar, some slightly similar upbringing, maybe, that like leads to a bizarre and curious sense of humor. So, dude, what's been going on with you, man? Like, last time I think I talked to you, you're living in Canada.
I am. Yeah, I'm north of the border, and it's been good. I moved to Vancouver at the beginning of 2016.
Oh, okay.
And to come to ILM, as a matter of fact.
Oh, right. No kidding. Yeah, the Canadian ILM, not to be confused with the American ILM.
That's right. That's right. It's Canadian.
It's a maple syrup company, right?
That's right.
I love maple syrup.
Maple syrup and hockey. That's what it's all about.
That's cool. Like, so I think in keeping with our theme, and we can talk about anything you want, like that comes up as we go, but okay. I was, a lot of this stuff is just for fun to like talk to old friends and stuff for me.
Yeah.
But I think too, like for a lot of like, you know, students and stuff, it's fun to hear all these like crazy journeys that people have on their path. But I know some of this stuff, but just for people listening, like where did you grow up?
I grew up in Southern California, and I grew up, mostly in Southern California. About 3 years of when I was a kid, I was in Virginia, not too far from where you are. I think we talked about this in Rico County. I'm calling from your house right now.
I'm behind you. You were born smoking cigarettes then, most likely, right?
Yes. Secondhand. Yeah. Nonstop. My parents didn't smoke, though, but everyone else seemed to.
Well, in Virginia, the home of cigarettes, you know.
Home of tobacco. Big tobacco.
So you lived here for a little while, and then you were born in California, but you lived in Virginia for a while, and then went back to California?
I did. I lived in Virginia for 3 years when I was, 9 to 13.
Oh, okay.
9 to 12. And then returned to California right as a teenager at 13. And,
so for like middle school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those really comfortable years.
I loved it. I was super confident. I knew exactly what I was doing and who I was as an individual. And, yeah, and then happy ending after that. It's all good stuff.
So like what did your dad do?
Okay, my dad has always or had always worked in theme park management.
Right.
So as a kid in Southern California, my dad worked at Disneyland. And, I have a lot of great memories about going to work, hanging out with my dad in his office and at Disneyland from his office window, that was like early 70s.
Yeah.
You could see, Space Mountain under construction.
Cool.
He would hand me a book of tickets. At the time, you had to have all the tickets to get on the rides.
Right, yeah, the e-tickets and stuff, sure.
The e-tickets, and he'd be like, here's some tickets, meet me at this time, we'll have lunch. And I would walk from his office, through the parking lot, the employee parking lot, this is my favorite memory, though, is walking through the sort of break area for the costume characters. And it's like basically like a collection of picnic tables where these probably teenagers, but like, yeah, to me, it was like, oh, there's Goofy and Mickey. And like, they had their, basic helmets on the picnic table and they're all just sitting there smoking cigarettes, looking at me. And I walk fast
and then
go through the gate to enter Main Street. And then, it's like transformed to this magical place. But all these other people don't know that all the costume characters are back there smoking cigarettes at picnic tables. It's ruined the illusion for me at an early age.
That's cool though. So, but that must have been so much fun though, like having like your dad do that kind of work.
It was fun. Yeah. You know, and years of therapy later, I've sort of come to terms. But no, it was a really cool thing to have, and to have that kind of access to Disneyland. And then, you know, and that was the reason we moved to Virginia, because he ended up working at King's Dominion.
Oh, yeah. That's not far from my house.
Yeah. And at the time that
my son lost his glasses there on a field trip in junior high. I've got to go back there someday.
See, maybe in the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
The three-quarter replica of... yeah, so... And then that's why we returned to Southern California after Virginia, is that my dad was, general manager at Marineland,
which was
incidentally where I had my first job, working in the toy shop. Do you know what I did in this toy store? They had a sand art, you know, this like basically this place where kids would go and they'd fill up a jar with different colors of sand.
Yeah, like a big litter box kind of.
Yeah, and I was the guy that teach them, like, here's how you make a seagull and a whale and, you know, different colored sand.
That's cool.
And I remember one Christmas I made this jar for my grandfather as a gift. It was a sunset with a seagull and a killer whale in colored sand.
Wow.
I handed it to him and he like started shaking it like he thought it was something that you shake and change the image. Like, wait, no.
You were like the Dalai Lama, like making like sand art in a jar at Marineland. That's pretty cool.
That was underpaid for that.
So, and did your mom work too?
She was mostly, she did in later years. Well, okay, probably in my teenage years, she started sort of working as like, just doing random, like, in Virginia, she worked at a company that made purses, these really popular kind of handbags.
Yeah.
And then later in Southern California, she worked at a bank and worked at a florist. And don't worry, you can edit these later. Like, oh my God.
There's too many jokes that I keep thinking that I want to say, but I won't say them yet. Now you're back in Southern California and you go to high school in Southern California, right?
Yes. Went to high school in Palos Verdes. And,
You like, as a kid, like at that age, were you into like movies at all? Or was that a thing that was on your radar? I know like I know you're really into like music and stuff.
I think music was more of my sort of creative passion type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think I had an appreciation for movies, but I wasn't really into film or movies like a lot of, like some other people were.
Right.
For me, it was more... The focus was definitely on music, and I was learning how to play guitar and just getting into different types of music at that time.
Was university education, was that something that like was expected kind of in your family? Were you going to go to a college?
No, not at all. I was definitely the only person that went to college in my family.
Really?
Yeah. My dad, he did go to college for a short time, but then sort of never graduated. And then my sister ended up not going to college. So it was sort of like, there wasn't in my family, there wasn't really an emphasis on, you know, go to this school and pursue this type of thing. So it ended up being sort of my own drive that kind of pushed me to do that. And,
what do you think made you want to go? Like, where did you go to school?
I went to UC Berkeley.
What made you want to do that? Do you think, was there somebody like a guidance counselor or anything like that? Or was there like friends that were doing stuff that you were just like, this seems like a good idea?
I think it was a friend, you know, it was through music, and I, you know, in junior high, I'd spent years taking guitar lessons and playing with friends and playing in bands. But then towards the end of high school, like I got into this band with some older guys and, they were writing songs and we were playing clubs in Hollywood, and the drummer, his older sisters were in the Bengals. And so it was really fun. And, you know, we got to sort of rehearse where they used to rehearse, and they would show up to our shows in Hollywood. But
that's such a cool brush with, like, you know, a different kind of celebrity. That's kind of interesting and exciting when you're that age, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. It was, and it made it feel possible, like, hey, this music thing, you know, anything could happen. Look at these people. They're already on MTV and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
but in terms of going to college, it was probably one of the bigger influences for me was the singer and songwriter in this band I was playing with. Mm-hmm. And, he was into philosophy, and he was, you know, it's like, read this, check this person out. And then, you know, I started reading reading these philosophers and, kind of getting into that. And I thought, you know, I should really get going, because in high school I was just, you know, playing guitar and working at a gas station. And,
and I gather that wasn't something like that kind of like intellectual pursuit wasn't something that was like a big deal in your house growing up.
Not necessarily. I mean, I did okay in school, but I definitely knew that I had the potential to do better, but it was sort of like, you know, music, guitar. Yeah. And then after high school, it's like, okay, what now? Time to turn this mothership around and do something. And, so I did that. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so at Berkeley, what did you study?
I was a philosophy major.
Excellent. Very good.
ready to straight on that career path to the Disneyland break room picnic tables. Yeah.
And wearing your goofy costume with your head in your lap, smoking a pack of Terrytons or whatever.
Yeah.
Right on. So you're at Berkeley, and like had you spent much time in Northern California, like when you were before going up there?
No, I had one friend who was a year ahead of me in high school who was at Berkeley. And I think I went up to visit him once. It's like, oh, this is kind of cool up here. And I'd been to San Francisco, I think, one other time.
Yeah.
When I was a teenager.
It's weird, like people, because I mean, I had that exact same experience going from, you know, Southern California to like the suburbs, like going to Northern California to go to university. And it always seems strange, like it was, you know, far enough away from home that like it felt good to be there. But it also, I think it's weirdly, at least at that time in the sort of late 80s, like it was pretty different. It was a different vibe than, you know, Southern California. I always used to think in Southern California, I never really thought about Northern California. And then you come to Northern California and they hate everything that's from Southern California, you know? So weird.
It's like, wait, is that me? Yeah. I remember feeling, you know, spending time in Berkeley or just Northern California for, you know, during the first part of that, and thinking like, this is really nice. It's really different, but it's like, it kind of opened up it's like, oh, there's seasons here and it gets colder here. And there's like, not every day is sunshine and beautiful weather.
Yeah. And it opened up your nasal passages.
Yes.
Along with that your too. Mind.
That's right. It happened in conjunction.
So no, in school, so you finish your degree?
I did. Yeah. I graduated UC Berkeley in 1990.
Oh, right on. And what did you do after graduation? Did you like find any work, like, or did you go back to Southern California or stay up north? Or
I stayed in Berkeley. I had become friends when I was in at school, become friends with this woman who was older at the time, but she was also in the philosophy program. And she lived in a house in North Berkeley, and her husband was an attorney in San Francisco, and ended up renting a room from them like my last year of college. And that basically turned into a job for me at his law firm.
Yeah.
And
as a legal aid office assistant, not legal aid, but a like office assistant type job, or
pretty much like I ended up doing. It was a small-ish law firm. I think there were maybe like four attorneys, and And what I ended up doing was a bit of everything. Like I took over their billing. I took over like paralegal duties. I would do deposition summaries. And
it's kind of interesting. I mean, it's like weird, like, but you know, it's like an interesting job.
At the time, a lot of philosophy graduates would go to law school. And I knew I didn't have any interest in going to law school, but I honestly had no clue what I wanted to do. And this was kind of like, oh, here's a job that I can keep doing. And
were you still playing in bands like in college too?
Not so much in college, but after I graduated and moved, I think I moved to San Francisco in 92. I had sort of picked it up again and was playing music with some people and just kind of here and there, but nothing really that serious. Just kind of. Yeah.
So what happens after the gig at the law firm?
So I think it was at the end of 1994 and somewhere around when the whole .com thing was it? Well,
that's kind of when it was getting started, I think, really 94 probably, right?
Yeah. So at somewhere kind of, I guess it might've been early 95 or end of 94. I took this, I was still at the law firm, but I had applied for this internship at the time, what was called a multimedia company. And these guys were doing essentially what was like, something like Movie Phone. Remember Movie Phone? Like, welcome to Movie Phone.
You know? If you know the name of the movie you want to see, press one.
Press one.
Yeah.
So, totally. So it was essentially that, but it was for music and books. But what was cool is that I was learning programming. It's like, look, you could telephony, they were calling it. Uh-huh. You could learn this programming language so that you can go through these dialogues and say, like, I like this band, and it had speech recognition too. So you could say the name of the band or you could type it on the phone keypad, this kind of thing. So like, oh, this is cool.
That's interesting. I didn't know that actually. Like, so you had some like weird, like entree into like programming, like through just like a straight up gig from, out of college. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, by that time I had already been working with this law firm for almost 5 years, and I knew that I wanted to get into something more technical.
Yeah, you were getting a little too reliable, maybe.
Yeah. Well, and it was like, it was pretty heavy stuff. Like, I love the people at this law firm, but at the same time, he was a criminal defense attorney, and he's a great guy. And he had clients at San Quentin on death row. And part of the job was like researching, you know, clients and all these depositions and really detailed accounts of murders. And it's like, oh my God,
kind of dark stuff for sure.
Dark. Yeah. One kind of funny, I don't know, you might want to edit this out, but one kind of funny thing is my friend and roommate at the time, who was also working at the law firm, was doing research on one of the people that were on death row. And, he, as part of this research, is like sort of like researching someone's entire history and childhood and going back and talking to people. So as part of this, he calls up our client's PE teacher when he was like a teenager or something. It's like, hey, do you remember so-and-so? And can you tell me a little bit about what you remember about this person? And so they have this long conversation. And then at the end of it, the PE teacher says, so, well, how's he doing? What's going on with him? He goes, well, actually not too good. He's on death row at San Quentin. And the PE teacher just said, ooh, bummer. And that became sort of a, I don't know, never mind. The understatement of the year.
The ultimate understatement. Yeah. Yeah. Jeez. Dang.
Bummer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's true. It is that's a bummer for sure. The ultimate bummer. That's rough. Yeah, well, I mean, I do think that's something that, like, at any workplace environment, when you work in long hours and stuff, this has come up a lot on conversations I've had with people. And I know you and I definitely did this when we were working in those early days at ILM, but that sort of gallows humor, you know, that you...
Oh, for sure.
Because it's just one of the things you do to sort of pass time and to make light of what can at times be kind of stressful situations, you know? And I think a lot, I think everybody does that, but it always does, like, in, you know, in hindsight, it's like, yeah, I guess that's in pretty bad taste.
It's in bad taste, but at the time it's like, it's a coping strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's pretty normal. So you go to work at this, company that's doing like kind of a movie fund style
Welcome
thing.
To movie fund. Yeah, these guys were in Hayes Valley. Okay. And at the same time, my girlfriend at the time was telling me about her good friend from college that was working at ILM in San Rafael. And that was Kay Ruff. And
oh, no kidding.
She goes, if you want, you know, I can pass your resume to her and see if there's anything that, you know, might suit, you know, they might have.
How did I, so you know, that is so weird. I did not know that like Kay Ruff was your like introduction to ILM. That is so, how did I not know that after all these years? Like that is so weird because you guys are both like good friends of mine. I never knew that was the connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Kay Ruff was my in. And then of course, Gail Curry was, you know, I have to thank her for my entire career. In fact, I think I did at one point at a cigarette, I ran into Gail Curry and I said that to her, like, I have to thank you for taking a chance on some liberal arts major from UC Berkeley. No other experience in CG or no, you know, no real idea.
That's really cool. Yeah, she, Gail is just such a cool lady. Gail Curry was the computer graphics department. I don't know what her title was exactly, but she was like the department manager. And mm-hmm. so she, everybody interviewed with her and stuff. She's just such a cool lady. So, yeah. So you go up and interview for that job. Like, was that when you're talking to Kay and like finding out about it, did that sound like really interesting to you? Were you like, yeah,
it did. I think it sounded like, oh, this is too good to be true because, you know, even though I wasn't on the same level as a lot of people there in terms of being a film buff or a film mm-hmm. geek or a Star Wars geek, it was like, oh yeah, no, this is the kind of place where I want to be. Like, I want to be learning about technical stuff, but also see the sort of creative result on the screen.
Yeah. And it's definitely it's got definitely both of those bits going on.
Yeah. And, in fact, I remember, I think it must've been at the time when I was back in college living in Berkeley and on the local news, it was like animators from Industrial Light and Magic, you know, are making these dinosaurs, blah, blah, blah. And I remember seeing on the news footage of animators kind of walking around the parking lot behind Cookie Bay or whatever it was. And, you know, walking around like they're walking like dinosaurs. And I thought, that's kind of odd, but it's kind of cool because I know what they did. I know what they're doing. And,
yeah. Yeah. They look ridiculous, but I bet that's a cool job.
Right.
So you wind up taking that job and you come to ILM and did you start as a CG resource assistant? Was that your first?
I did. Yeah. I was That's where we met. Yeah. I was hired immediately.
I was so high. I don't remember.
I'm so high right now. I don't remember what you just asked me. Okay.
I wish.
I do remember this conversation I had with Gail. It's like, Mike, we want to hire you, but we just hired this really incredible woman, so we can't have you start until a month later. And I said, okay. And she had just hired Polly Ng.
Oh, yes. Indeed, a very incredible and incredibly gifted and intelligent woman, for sure.
She is, absolutely. And but yeah, Matt, I don't know if you remember, but I started as a CGRA, CG resource assistant.
Right.
And I have a vivid memory of you from my first day at ILM because, you know, I don't know how it transpired, but I, you know, came in and was shown to my desk and like, oh, this is Matt Wallen and he's going to give you a tour. And
I was like, great.
And you're like, oh, who's this guy? So what I remember from this tour with you is like, you kind of walked me around C building and, you know, this is the Raiders of the Lost Ark sarcophagus or whatever. You remember we had all these props in the building?
Sure.
I walked down the stairs and then I don't know why, but you walked over to this phone, which is like I wouldn't say it's a rotary phone, but it was an old analog phone.
Yeah.
And you're like, and this is the only phone that works in this entire company when the power goes out. Like, okay. So if the power goes out, this is the phone you need. Okay.
I wonder if that was even true. Like, somebody probably told me that on my first day or something. I don't know if that was.
I don't know. I don't know.
What but a weird thing to say.
I started as a CG computer graphics resource assistant. And
all the glamour of the resource assistant job.
Yeah, all like, the glamour.
Yeah, allocating processors for nighttime render jobs.
Yeah.
Like the least like glamorous gig. But what was kind of cool about that job, I think, though, is that you learned a lot about like what was happening on a show and what a show needed. And you got to communicate with a lot of different people who would like call you and ask you or email or whatever on the intranet and ask you for procs and stuff like that. And you got to kind of interact with the production. And I don't know, it's kind of a cool way to learn it.
I think it was fantastic. I mean, like, you got to go to dailies. It was like a master course in how to work in visual effects. Like, I remember the first project I got assigned to was Mission Impossible. Mm-hmm. And it was like, and I got to go to dailies. So I went to dailies every day and sitting in, I think it was D screening room, and it was just a small screening room with like three couches.
Yeah.
And so here I am on the back couch, and in the front row is Joe Letteri, George Murphy, and John Knoll.
Yeah.
And like, you know, only later did I fully appreciate like how
awesome that was. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's like, oh my gosh, like I can't imagine that first job is like seeing these guys work and learning, you know.
Yeah, it's like being back in school, really, in a way, like when you're in that role at that age too, like coming in and sort of getting to work with these, you know, who now we look at them and they're just like, oh, they're totally like luminaries, like in the industry. But like having that that sort of interaction where it's like, hey, they know your name, like you're working with them on the show and you're just this like, you know, young kid, like, yeah, that's the kind of thing that's like at the moment I never appreciated it, but in hindsight I look back on that and just think like, god, like what a dope I was that I didn't connect. I didn't see it, you know. I didn't see how amazing that was until later.
Yeah, same here. I just, you know, at the time it's just like, oh, you're just doing this, but later it's like, wow, that was really a special experience. That was pretty amazing.
That RA job, like if memory serves right, like they would always ask you to do it for a year, I think was kind of the sort of drill, right? And if you did it for a year and there were opportunities, you could go, you know, different routes, like into, you know, certain kind of creative routes or technical routes. And like, you wound up going and becoming a TA, is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I did have a brief moment when I was... That's exactly right. Like work at this job a year and then sort of decide where you want to go next.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point before the year had ended, I was like, you know, I have this background in music. It's like, oh, Skywalker Sound, wouldn't that be amazing? And I think I had talked to some people at Skywalker Sound. And I remember having a quick conversation with Gail Curry, like, hey, you know, what do you think about this? Because you committed to a year and,
right.
You know, I don't know, but it turned out like, it's good that I didn't, you know, it turned out to be a good thing that I stuck it through. And then after being a CGRA, resource assistant, I think I did every sort of technical support job at ILM before I moved into Creatures. Like the next step was, tape IO.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was essentially at that time, all of the information on disk, you'd write out to these exabyte tapes.
Yeah, you're like the slave to the machine.
Oh my god, it was just like, and then walk these tapes over to the scanning department, and they would, you know, transfer them to film. And
did
then,
you use Brucer's Superback program?
Of course, amazing. Robert Bruce. That
yeah,
guy,
what was yeah. this? What was the story on Superback? I've heard different versions of this, but
I think Robert Bruce, his login was Brucer, so we all called him Brucer.
Yeah, he's super, and such a sweet guy too. He's like really smart and like
super smart, really sweet. And he's like, Brucer had this idea for this, you know, this algorithm that backs up all of our information, so we don't have to worry about this because we apparently didn't have it at the time.
Right.
So Superback, and I think he like essentially stayed up for like 3 days, and there were like, you know, a 12
writing
pack
this tool and
a case of empty Coke cans on his desk.
Right.
And then the version one you know, did something wrong and all of these backups were wrong. And he's like, oh no. And then,
Didn't it delete all this a whole bunch of data from some show? Like, instead of backing it up, it just straight up erased it, and it was like this the worst. I mean, like, because he was really young too. He was like, I mean, he was younger, I think, than you and me, and he was like so earnest and enthusiastic, and was really trying to do something really good. And it just somewhere along the line, there was some little bit in there that was flipped, or a few bits maybe flipped the wrong way. And I remember there was so upset, which, I mean, in the end, it wasn't that big a deal, but
it wasn't a big deal. And he fixed it. But yeah, you're right. It was like major glitch. He's like, oh no, kind of reminds me of another major glitch. There used to be this script called DistDots.
Oh, sure.
Which would distribute all of your dot files, all of these hidden files. And somehow someone ran it, or like, I always had this fear, like, I'm going to run this script that like deletes all this information overnight. And then next day in dailies, I was like, where's everything?
Corcoran deleted it all.
Corcoran ran it. Anyway, not very interesting of a story, I guess, but DistDots had been run and like obliterated everyone's, you know, dot files.
Well, yeah, it would distribute your dot files, like your preferences and stuff, to like all the machines on the network, right? And so if you ran DistDots and they would change it and update and stuff, but there was a point where it ran and it like somehow it got like it
overwrote all the dot files. It wasn't just the ones owned by you or something like that.
Right. Or like it didn't quit. And so it went into some recursive behavior where it just like, it kept running. And like, people were like, the whole network is down. Like, what's going on? And it's like, you know, Habib or somebody's running, they ran their disk dots. Like, it's just so weird. Like all these crazy kind of early, I mean, in a way, like that's really kind of early days certainly for computer graphics, but for a lot of those kind of like big, like sort of corporate network things, like I'd never been around anything like that before. And so it was kind of interesting. Some of the problems that would come up, they were so, sometimes so strange and like took a while to figure out what was going wrong, you know,
really strange. And, you know, at the same time I was trying to learn Unix and, you know, shell, you know, programming, scripting, things like that. It's like, what is going on?
Did you enjoy that? Like the technical aspect of like taking on those types of like kind of that new language, like that new sort of way of thinking? Did it connect in any way? I've always wondered, did it connect in any way for you to music, maybe in some way?
I think it connected in a way, in a creative way, because I liked the fact that you had to know whatever language it was or whatever the you know, system. You had to know Unix. You had to know whatever programming language at the time. It was Perl. Maybe it was becoming more Python.
Yeah.
But just the creative part of it, it connected on that way, I guess, because
I've just noticed over the years, like so many, like, you know, technical directors and effects animation people that I've worked with at different like companies. And when I had my business for a while, like my two partners were both effects TDs and they were both musicians. And I always thought it was so interesting how like, it seemed like there's a kind of a natural kind of connective tissue maybe to some of those modalities and to maybe writing or playing an instrument.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it's just basic creativity, right? Like if you're looking at, say, for example, programming or scripting or whatever, and you're looking at someone else's code, it's like, oh, this is how they did it. You know, you're kind of like going through and trying to see how their approach might differ from something that you come up with. So for me, it was more of a creativity thing. Like, oh, this is really interesting to see how this person had done it.
Yeah, that's cool. So from the TA universe, like, do you, I can't remember now, when did you start doing creature stuff? Was that your first big like entree into like a kind of creative path?
It was. I had gone from, you know, resource assistant to tape.io to render support. At the time they were calling it mail job, but it was
right.
And at some point, I can't remember when, it might have been 97 or early 98. Tim McLaughlin and Kevin Reuter came into the TA trailer and they're like, hey, you know, we're we're looking for people that are interested in creature work, and namely enveloping, which they were calling at the time. Mm-hmm. It's like how recruiting people essentially to learn how to do skin weighting at the time was, you know, kind of a different process. ILM used to have this software called ILM 3D that would, you know, kind of map out skin weights in kind of like UV space. So like, it was almost like you had to look at like a graph paper and, you know, on an elbow that bends, you know, how much of the skin on the outside stretches versus how much on the inside pinches and has a sharper fall off. Right. All of this would be defined in that kind of like UV parameter space. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. You know, I think at the time, a lot of the people going from support jobs was like, I either want to be a lighter TD or I want to be an animator. I want to go into compositing. And then there were a handful of people that ended up going into creatures, which was, you know, me and Robert Bruce, Aaron Ferguson, Michelle Dean, and
Dugan Beach.
Dugan Beach. And, you know, these were a lot of these people. I could say myself, Dugan Beach, and Aaron Ferguson, fellow Cal graduates, you know, it kind of reflected the era of like hiring a liberal arts major to sort of, ILM would bring in these liberal arts majors and basically let them learn how to do more technical stuff. So,
that's actually a super interesting aspect of the period of time that you and I were at that sort of incarnation of ILM, that sort of, you know, that San Rafael sort of early computer graphics stage ILM. I don't know if it's still like that. I don't know if you get a lot of in the different sort of technical fields in visual effects, if you're seeing as much like people coming out of those more liberal arts backgrounds and sort of learning the trade on the job. I don't know if it functions that way still.
I don't think it does. From what I've seen, it's very specific these days on, you know, computer science degrees. And,
yeah. Because you can now go to a university and study in a more kind of focused way a certain type of computer graphics or digital image processing that's focused on, you know, specific entertainment sort of outcomes, games or movies or
right. I mean, these people come out of those schools and they know Maya inside and out, Unreal Engine, Photoshop, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Whereas, I wonder if anything's lost in that. Like, I mean, it's so speculative, but like, I just wonder if anything is lost in kind of not having some of those really, because I feel like that's such a unique aspect of that period of time is that there were people who were, you know, all, like pretty much everybody I'm talking to, like who's kind of in our peer group, like very few came out of a computer science background. And I think, I don't know, there's something interesting in there, I guess. I don't know. I don't know if I could put my finger on what it is, but.
Well, I don't know about you, but I felt like I had to, after some period of time at early days at ILM, I felt like I needed to do catch up. Like I remember taking a UC Berkeley extension course on Unix and then years later, I ended up going back to graduate school only for a year, but I did computer science.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, but yeah, it was just fascinating and really inspiring to work with people that were so good at what they did. And it was just like, you know,
all definitely of these, like so many like really, really just brilliant people for sure.
Yeah. Like there, it was like this kind of the early days for me at ILM was sort of this like tribal knowledge. It's like, oh, if you need to know something about this, go talk to so-and-so. And, you know, it was just like you could always get an answer just by walking to, you know, their desk and whatever, you know.
Yeah, people were really generous with like sharing knowledge and sharing information. Like there was a very team and kind of egalitarian attitude that like permeated the facility for the most part, where it was like information was there to be shared, not to be, you know, guarded.
Yeah, exactly. Like I never experienced that sort of guarded thing at ILM in those early days. It was
Did you wind up? I can't remember. Were you in that trailer that was between C and D buildings? The house of pain, was that what it's called?
I wasn't in that. I wasn't in the House of Pain. I was in the White House for a while.
Okay.
I didn't have a desk in the House of Pain, but I had, I guess, towards the end.
You left some pain in there.
It was a House of Pain, but it wasn't called House of Pain.
Okay.
No, but it was, right. No, but I had, I guess, like, when I started as a Creature Tea, my first show was episode one, and
Just that little show.
That little show, yeah. Like, here, fix this character. And it's like, it turned out to be working on Jar Jar, and of all characters. Like, but yeah, I was up in our office upstairs in, was it D building? But it was with, I was sat right next to Steve Rollins and.
Oh, right.
Corey Rosen, and then Gene Bolte and Stuart Liu.
Yeah. That's cool. I have this incredible, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking of this memory of like going and talking to Dugan in the trailer that was between C and D building.
Yes.
And he was working on Ben Quadraneros, the pod race character. And he was at the time, I mean, we were all pretty young, but I just remember he got so... Something went wrong with Ben Quad, and he got so angry, and he just unleashed this like tirade of like rage and like curse words and stuff in frustration at something like about Ben Quad, and like it was just funny.
I love Dugan. I remember that reminds me of one conversation I had with Dugan around that time. I think I was walking past the House of Pain, and he was outside in that kind of outdoor area. And he was looking all upset and bummed out. I was like, hey, dude, what's up? And he goes, ah, man. And he was upset because he had been assigned all of the fucking Gungans. I've got to envelope all of these fucking Gungans. I'm like, what? He goes, yeah, man. He's really been out of shape. It's like, okay, that's...
It's so funny, like thinking back on it, just hearing just the language of it is just too funny because it's like it's so ridiculous. I've got to envelope all the Gungans. Like, I mean, that does sound like a bummer, really. Like, I mean, that sounds like a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. But the other thing that I want to say is that I do remember that time being sort of like supported as an artist because I had no concept and no clue. And you know, I would go into, at that time it was Ken Murayama who was mm-hmm. kind of overseeing the creature yeah. developers at the time is what they were calling them. And
he's such a great manager. He was so great at that.
He was the best. And again, at that time, it's like, you don't have a full appreciation of what you have because like, oh, this must be the norm.
Yeah. But, this is what managers do.
Yeah. But I remember having this conversation with Ken Murayama and it's like, I had just been working on episode one and it was just like corrective shapes for Jar Jar's ears intersecting his shoulder and Jar Jar's vest intersecting his abdomen. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, you know, that I think that at the time that was one of the first cloth solvers.
Yeah.
Written by John Anderson.
Yep.
Janders. and Ken Murayama called me into his office and he's like, Mike, you know, we have a couple of other projects. Just wanted to ask you what you might be interested in. At that time, it was like Mighty Joe Young or Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, I don't know. Maybe Pearl Harbor. And then I remember he stood up and walked over and he goes, Mike, let me just tell you, you don't want Pearl Harbor. You want Mighty Joe Young. That's a hero character. He goes, you know, Pearl Harbor is just a bunch of digital doubles. It's like, okay, I'll do Mighty Joe Young. And that turned into a really great experience for me because I was the only creature developer, creature TD on that show. And, you know,
just yeah, and that was like, that was a big deal for the company doing that type of character with the fur and.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It was just like, it hadn't been done before. And Carl Frederick wrote the fur shader.
Right.
Hiromi Ono wrote this like crazy, like sample hair simulation that kind of gave hair dynamics, fur dynamics. Mm-hmm. And,
was Joey Alter on that project too, or?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I'm just thinking, cause he later went on to do
Shave and a Haircut.
I wonder if I just wondered if there was any,
I didn't even know that he was at ILM.
He was there. I know he was there during Casper. I I don't know. He's on my list, though. I'll talk to him at some point.
Oh, yeah. Great. I'd be curious to hear
get his story.
But Ken Murayama was just like, he and Gail Curry stand out to me as like these kind of mentors that helped, you know, push me in the right direction when I really had no clue, no idea. And then, and it turned out years later when, you know, I had left ILM, Ken Murayama kind of helped me get back into the business.
So like after episode one and then, Mighty Joe Young, what year did you leave ILM?
I left Kerner in 2000.
Okay. So a year after I left, roughly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think I'd started in June of 95 and I think I left in June of 2000. So almost 5 years.
Did you have like another gig lined up that you were going for? Or were you just like, I got to take a break from this, or what was the deal?
I had to take a break. It's kind of funny. I don't know if you remember, but at the time at ILM, if you worked 5 years, you qualified for a 30-day sabbatical. And
wait, what? you could? I never did one of those.
Oh, they didn't tell you? Okay.
They kept that one secret from me.
Yeah, so I had my girlfriend at the time, who later became my wife and is now my ex-wife.
Awkward.
Who is a fantastic person that I'm friends with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So at that time, 2000, she had applied for law school at UC Davis, mm-hmm. and got accepted to the program. And I had taken this 30-day sabbatical and kind of like spent 30 days in Davis, California. And I think during that point, we had moved there, and knowing that she was going to law school, I was like, how's my commute from Davis to San Rafael going to be? So I ended up coming back from the sabbatical and kind of giving my notice.
Yeah. And it was a little too much of a commute, maybe.
It was. And I think at the time I was just kind of felt that I was ready for a change or something different.
So what did you do after that?
I actually spent 3 years as a freelance programmer.
Really?
And
so programming like for what kind of things were you doing?
Well, I ended up, I say freelance, but really it was essentially one company. It was an internet service provider in Davis. And I was, you know, kind of writing their backend, what they called backend hosting software. And you know, going back to Robert Brucer, to full props to him, because that guy really supported me and helped me during that period of like, you know, Brucer, they're asking me to write this kind of program that does this, this, and this. And
was kind of mentoring you through some of that.
He was helping me quite a bit.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's so interesting. So you'd learned really, I mean, aside from the help that you needed, like you'd learned enough like programmatic skills that like you could be tasked with a specific kind of, thing that somebody's asking you to build, and you could sort of see your way to like, okay, well, I'm going to need this, this, and this. And you could kind of figure out what those pieces were to actually write something that worked.
I think I fumbled through it, but I think like looking back, I also realize and appreciate that, you know, working at ILM sort of became kind of a golden ticket, because like, if I was just a guy on the street, I'm pretty sure this guy at the internet service provider company would say, I don't think so.
Right. But like, you had that background. And so it's like with that on your resume, people were like, it opened a lot of doors.
It did open a lot of doors. And, you know, I had to hustle and really learn and catch up, because I really didn't know what I really didn't know how to write this backend hosting software and mm-hmm. all of this stuff. But all of the sort of like sysadmin stuff and Unix stuff that I had learned at ILM over the previous 5 years kind of paid off, because, you know, all of this internet service provider stuff, I was familiar with a lot of the Unix stuff, and that really helped.
Well, and it's like once you learn any, like, I mean, language, smanguage, like I think once you learn sort of the core principles involved in any language, like they all have their different quirks and different syntax or whatever. But once you kind of learn some of those base skills, I think you can kind of pick up other languages too.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're doing that kind of work, freelancing, and Megan is in law school, and is so when she are you you stay there till she finishes law school?
We stayed there until she finished, you know, 3-year program. She graduates 2003. We decide to move back to San Diego, and early 2004, I'm still working remotely from this internet service provider. And I'm in San Diego, and there's a SIGGRAPH that happens to be in San Diego. It's like, you know what? I'm going to go to SIGGRAPH and check this out.
See some old friends.
See some old friends. Who do I run into when I walk into the convention center in San Diego? Ken Murayama.
Oh, right on.
He goes, Mike Corcoran, what? How the hell are you? You know, puts his arm around me.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, Ken, I'm considering, you know, getting back into visual effects. And he goes, I got to introduce you to someone. I'm going to take you over to so-and-so. And he walks me over to the DreamWorks booth and introduces me to Deborah Blanchard.
Oh, wow.
And that's how I got my job at DreamWorks as a creature TD in 2004, where I ended up working at DreamWorks for about a year.
Wow. So you guys are living in San Diego. You're working at DreamWorks. DreamWorks is in LA. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I got the job at DreamWorks, relocated to Pasadena.
Oh, okay.
And it was, you know, commuting from Pasadena to Glendale, campus.
Wow. Cool. That's so cool. So how long do you wind up at DreamWorks for?
I was at DreamWorks for a year. And
were you on there? Did you?
I ended up getting, so I think at the time it was a 3-picture deal. And so in the course of a year, I think I worked on 3 pictures because I think I had signed on to work on a film called Over the Hedge.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and this is all feature animations. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that part after?
I dozed off for a few minutes there.
I'm sorry. What was the part after? Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show. Yeah. yeah. So what did I work on?
It doesn't really matter.
Hang on a second. Let me hit record. Did we do that yet?
I'm afraid we're out of time here, Mike. It's been
let's talk again next week, okay?
We'll pick it up there next time. So you're at DreamWorks, you do that for a year, and that's what happens at the end of that year?
Towards the end of the year, I can't remember how it came about, but I saw a job posting for Weta Digital for King Kong, and they were looking for people. So I had, you know, put my application in.
You had that Mighty Joe Young experience.
Yes. That's right. I got it. Like, I've got to, you know, roll this ape experience into something else.
Yeah. Well, working with Joe on Mission Impossible too, though. Right. Cause Joe was the head honcho, really, Joe Leteri at, Weta by that point.
That's right. And that, again, it goes back to the golden ticket thing. Yeah. Like I got there and I at some point had a conversation with Joe, and you know, we even talked about Carl Fredericks. Like, yeah, Carl wrote the first shader on Mighty Joe Young, and Joe is like, yeah, I was talking to him, I tried to get him down here too. And but
that's cool. Yeah, and Megan was up for that kind of adventure too, so it just seemed like a good opportunity and something to do.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. And, you know, just to have a chance to live somewhere like that. And
yeah,
you know, you were there too. I mean, years later, we reconnected there. And
I remember you, me, and Dugan going out to lunch.
That's right.
And Dugan had like a Volkswagen bus or something that he that he drove, that he had his surfboards in or something, I think. And you guys had been there for months.
Actually, Dugan bought this, I think it was like one of those Ford vans that you don't see anywhere in North America, but it was like right-hand drive, and he bought it. It's like, it used to be a flower van. So it had this fan on top that would spin in the wind.
And that's cool.
I think we even joked at that lunch, like about him complaining about Gungans. Cause like, you know, it's like, I got a fucking envelope King Kong now.
Well, I remember when I showed up, it was like, I think it was like 3 or 4 months before the show was supposed to be finished. And I, the day I showed up, I think it was, maybe it was when we went to lunch. I remember somebody who told me, they said, yeah, you know, we've been working on this show for a year and we haven't been able to render a full frame of King Kong with fur yet.
Yeah. I'm telling you, Weta had this sort of bravado and swagger that I wasn't used to. And it's like, how the fuck are we going to get this done? You know, yeah. What's going on? It's like, don't worry about it. We did Lord of the Rings. We've got this. And I was like, we're getting really close to the delivery date. And we don't even know how we're going to simulate fur. But everyone was like strangely calm. And I remember that being a very stressful time for me. Cause I was like, this movie's not going to happen. It's not going to get done. And then.
Well, I remember the Universal executives were flying to New Zealand and they were going to go to whatever that place was called, Park Post. They were going to go there and meet with Peter Jackson, and they were going to screen like the super long cut of King Kong, yeah. Right? And everybody was like, "Don't worry, like they're going to cut all these sequences. There's no way." And they screen the movie, and they're like, and everybody was like, "All right, so what did they cut?" And they're like, "Nothing." And we were like, "What?"
And we were in there for 5 hours.
Yeah. And what was crazy was, I don't know if your team had this experience, but so I was on the compositing side of things. And yeah. I remember those last 4 weeks of getting that show finished as a compositor. I think I did, and it sounds impossible, but if you do the math, this works. I think I did 110 hours a week. For yeah. 4 weeks. And I made like, you know, $40,000 in overtime or something like crazy, you know. But I remember I would go to work, I'd be there for dailies by like 8 or 8:15 in the morning. And yeah. I wouldn't get home, and you know, my wife and my son who turned 2 in New Zealand, like they would be asleep, you know, in the apartment that we had. And then I would go back home at about 3:30 AM. And they were asleep. And so I would literally come back, sleep for a couple hours and go back to work. And everybody in our group, they looked like zombies. Like nobody was doing really very good work. And people looked like they were just like, I after that job, I thought I would never, ever work again on another movie because I was just spent.
Yeah, I was with you on that. I remember that particular project. And I think, well... So that was King Kong 2005. I remember I left New Zealand. Like, I can't do this anymore. And yeah, because I was doing the same. I don't think I was doing as much as you because of compositing. You guys just
We got it everything at the end, you know?
You got hammered. Yeah. You know, I know I was doing like 90-hour weeks. And
I remember running into you and Megan at the airport. And... You guys had all these suitcases that weighed too much and you had to go out to the curb and you were like...
Just like throwing shit out. Like, fuck it, let's get out of here. Sleep deprived. Like, yeah. Nightmare.
I just remember that was such a bummer. I was like, oh, they have to throw away so many things. And Chrissy was like, should we go see what they have?
You should take this. It's amazing. Yeah, it was... God, what a crazy experience. And then...
So you guys never entertained the idea of staying?
I think Megan wanted to stay and I was like, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I really was kind of losing touch with reality and myself. And it was just too much.
Yeah.
Too dysfunctional. And, you know, as a result of that movie, like that company kind of restructured. And I remember, I think it was Joe was like, we can't do this again. We have to, yeah. You know.
Yeah. Cause it was hard on a lot of people. I mean, it did win the visual effects Oscar and stuff. I think it's too long of a movie, personally.
I didn't know why.
Yeah, it won the Oscar that year. I mean, it was a pretty amazing achievement at the time and stuff, but it's like you look back on it and I just think like, they probably could have cut like an hour out of that movie.
Yeah.
it still would have been pretty great.
I'd say the first hour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you come back to, did you go back to California?
I did. I returned to California. I was like returning to comfort, returning to home. Mm-hmm. I remember from New Zealand, like having a phone conversation with Lori Beck, who, you know, Lori used to be Ken Murayama's assistant when I was a creature developer, creature TD in the early days. But now Lori had shifted to recruiting and it's like, you know, please hire me, get me out of this nightmare. So I went back to ILM after they had moved from San Rafael to the Presidio.
Oh, wow. And I didn't know you were back there. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So I returned to ILM after they had moved to the Presidio, and I think that was 2006. Okay. Or no. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that sounds about right, because 2005, I think, was Kong came out at the end of that year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it was definitely a different feeling. Like, it was like, again, it felt like, oh, this is home. I know these people. I love these people. But at the same time, it was no longer the old location. So it felt different.
It was so crispy and kind of more corporate, maybe.
More corporate. I remember when I started, and it was just, it felt really sterile, and people didn't decorate their desk and stuff in the way that they used to. And then at some point George had walked through and he was like, where's everyone's, why don't the animators have toys on their desk or whatever he said. And then it's like, hey, everyone, it's okay. Go ahead and put stuff up on your desk.
And if you remember, it's Casual Fridays. If you want to wear your Hawaiian shirt and jeans.
Yeah. This Friday is Hawaiian shirt day. Yeah.
That's interesting. So it was like, so you got to kind of get a taste of kind of that other culture after it had moved too, and it really kind of changed some of its DNA, maybe changed a little bit.
It did change, but it still felt like, this, the great people. And, Janet Lewin was a producer, and, it's just really great to see how people, advance in the company and they're still there.
So you're at ILM in San Francisco at the new facility. And how long are you there for?
I was there for about a year and a half. I started working on, that was 2006. It was Spiderwick Chronicles. And then, and then Ben Snow, who had been a VFX soup on Kong, had also returned to ILM. And I think he was a VFX soup on Spiderwick. Mm-hmm. And then I shifted over to, what the hell was that called?
But you're still working, like, the whole time you're still working in Creature.
In Creature, exactly, yeah. So, and back with, Aaron Ferguson and all these other guys that I was, introduced to. And
yeah, just your peeps. Really,
what's that?
Your peeps, the old peeps. Crew, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I was back at the Presidio for about a year and a half. And then kind of jumped ship to go to the startup that Robert Zemeckis and Doug Chang started with Disney.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was like, that was a kind of crazy crowd. Like, didn't Huck Wirtz go and,
Jen Amberley.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a really exciting time. It was,
and Doug Chang was one of the partners in that, wasn't he?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. And his whole art department, his whole art company, was heading up that. And that to me turned into a really good gig, because I went from being sort of a Creature TD type to, heading up the hair and cloth department and, leading a team. And
really,
and,
so that was when you first kind of moved into like kind of a management kind of role.
Yes. Yeah.
And did that feel like for you, I mean, it seems obvious, I guess, but like having worked with, having Ken as a manager and stuff, like what a great role model. Like, did that feel like a really natural fit, like kind of taking on that kind of more senior position for you?
I think it was a bit challenging because I wasn't used to it, but I do remember sort of like thinking, channeling people like, what would Gail do or what would Ken do,
Sure.
Trying to sort of, channel your mentors kind of thing. And, and then also just really developing a good team of people. And, the whole trick for me is like assemble a team of people that know way more than you know, and are way better than you are kind of thing. It's like,
you're like, listen, you can't bullshit a bullshitter.
Listen, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing, so I sure the hell hope you do, because otherwise we're screwed. We have to write this pipeline. We need to.
So get on that way. So now that was when they did, what was the big show they did? Was that the Christmas Carol one?
Yeah, there were two projects out of that company before they ended up sort of going out of business after 3 years, but it was Christmas Carol.
Oops.
Yeah, that's... it's the truth, right? So, Christmas Carol and then Mars Needs Moms.
Oh, right. Right,
which, yeah, of course, you've seen.
Yeah, sure. haven't I? I'm sure I have.
And this is... Oh, go ahead.
No. What were you going to say?
So at the end of that was about the time where it's like, let me think about New Zealand again. And I think enough time had passed where I was sort of reconsidering returning to New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Yep.
And did you?
No. Yeah.
I don't even remember. Like, so you guys went back to New Zealand after...
Yeah. And I think I did about 6 years total in New Zealand, but 2005 was the first tour of duty.
Did you get residency there?
I did.
Huh.
Yeah.
Huh. And you left?
I know. But you know what? In New Zealand, I could be wrong, but in New Zealand, unlike Canada, if you get permanent residency and you leave the country, there's no sort of timeline on it. That's my understanding. I could be totally wrong.
So maybe you could go back.
Maybe I could go back. This is me in complete denial. Like, I left New Zealand in 2014. I can go back anytime.
When COVID 2022 hits. Dang. Well, that's really cool. So you went back and you were there for like, what was your role when you came back? Were you managing a team then too at Weta?
No, I wasn't managing. I think I went back to Weta as like a lead creature TD.
Mm-hmm.
And,
what shows were they doing there at the time?
I think I went back for Tintin.
Oh, right. Okay.
And that was actually a good experience for me because that, I think Tintin represents to me like the best sort of claw simulation that I've been involved with on digital characters. And I learned a lot through that process. I worked on Return of the Planet of the Apes. I did the Maurice, the orangutan that kind of swings along under the Golden Gate Bridge.
Maurice.
Simming dreadlocks.
Yeah, cool.
But one thing about that second tour of duty at Weta was that I was able to shift from creature TD to lighting.
Oh.
And I think part of that was just having that connection with Joe and that I was lucky because I had a conversation with Eileen early days, like, hey, Eileen, I'm interested in shifting over to lighting. And there was sort of a precedence in the creature group at Weta. Like, I think one or two people had sort of jumped back between creature TD and lighting TD.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
And lighting, you move into an area that's probably, at least cinematically, I don't know, I guess I think of that as being more cinematically creative in a strange way, whereas the, like, you know, cloth and hair sims and stuff, like, it's really technically creative and, like, it has a huge impact on what you see, but the lighting piece is so, it really directs the eye, you know, of the audience in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I felt like, I remember having this sense of relief, like, oh, I'm no longer having to deal with this set of problems that comes from, you know, running simulations and doing creature work.
Yeah.
And then learning lighting and getting that sort of end result was really rewarding. But at the same time, I'm also learning about this other set of problems that lighters have and challenges, which is like, okay, it's not an easy task at all. And it was really challenging for me because I didn't have the background in lighting that I had.
It's probably fun though too, in a way, I would think, just cause like it's a new learning curve, but like it's suddenly having all those difficulties and challenges, like it just becomes more interesting, right? Like, cause it's all new in some ways,
It is. It's all new. And again, it's kind of about being inspired by your coworkers and what you're seeing in dailies. Like, oh, you know, this person is making this stuff look really good. I want to figure out how they're doing it.
Well, and just learning another, like another kind of piece of the pipeline too, it just makes you I've talked about this a lot with my students, like this idea of you become, it sounds corny, but like you do become like a kind of a human Swiss Army knife, right? Like you have like all these things that you can deploy, like, and you become more useful to an organization too, as a, you know, an employee, because, you know, when you finish with one task, it's not like, all right, well, we're done with that. Like, all right, well, we don't have anything else for you. See you later. You can all of a sudden now you can move into doing lighting. And like, I mean, that became true in compositing too. Like, compositors started lighting stuff, right? Like, because it's a natural evolution to, and connecting those two things, and you become a broader scope kind of, you know, generalist, maybe specializing in a given area, but you have so many more skills. And I think that becomes really valuable from, if as an employer, that would be something you would want, right? So you don't have to constantly be going back to like, oh, now I've got to hire somebody who can do this other thing, right? Because it's like, because Mike can do both, you know? That's cool. So you guys stay there, you get residency, you work on some shows, and like, when did you guys decide to come back?
That was, let's see, what show was I finishing up on? I'd started lighting. I think I worked on Iron Man 2 and Apes 2 and then The Hobbit. I think it was at the end of The Hobbit. And I was, again, it was like another point of burnout. And to be honest with you, I think I was hitting some sort of like midlife crisis. Like, I need to come back and figure out what I want to do. And it turned out to be like, you know, returned to California and ended up, you know, getting a divorce and leaving visual effects for about a year and a half and kind of recalibrating, reassessing my life. It all in ways that turned out to be really great and healthy for me. But
what kinds of stuff were you doing like in that year and a half? Did you like have any like cool, I know of one of them, I think that I thought was pretty cool. Didn't you buy a truck and like...
I did.
And like, and do you like flat whites and stuff like that?
Yes, I did. One of the things about living in New Zealand, it was like, damn, the coffee is so good there and flat whites, and how the hell are they doing this?
Yeah.
And
that velvety shortly, foam.
Velvety smooth. And so shortly before I left New Zealand, the last time I ended up taking kind of like a coffee course from this place, this guy.
Yeah.
In Newtown. And
oh, right on.
And so I ended up like, how do you roast coffee? How do you make flat whites? How do you do all this stuff? And then I ended up buying a refurbished espresso machine from these guys and shipped it back to California. And so I got back to California with the idea that I'm going to start a business, and I want it to be sort of like a vintage musical instrument guitar shop with a coffee shop in it. And
it's so cool. It's like, take all the things that you're really into and like fuse them together. Like, I mean, it sounds so cool.
It was like a kid playing with Legos. Like, I'm going to build this and build this and live in this world. And then the reality kind of set in where it's like, the notion of a commercial lease and bricks and mortar and all of this overhead.
Yeah.
And somewhere in that process, I had
the health
found
department.
I'd seen this gourmet food truck for sale on Craigslist, and it was, it just ended up checking out this truck and talking to this woman. It turns out she had bought an old ice cream truck and converted it to a gourmet cupcake business. And then she was transitioning to bricks and mortar location and was selling the truck.
So I'm so curious, because I saw pictures of that truck. I never saw it in person, but like who made that thing? What was, do you remember who the manufacturer of that truck was? It was so crazy looking.
Oh yeah. It was a Chevy step van. I think it was an 83 step van.
Wow. Cause it had such a like total like industrial grade. I mean, it looked like a tank.
It was a tank. Those step vans, like the basic design didn't change essentially for decades.
Because I should say, we should talk about, you always had, like, ever since I've known you, you've always had some of the coolest cars. Like, you had that, the Lincoln Continental with the suicide doors. And it was like this baby blue.
Yeah.
That thing was
turquoise.
Yeah. Got like 6 miles to the gallon or something.
I wrote a song about that car. It was called Please Steal My Car. Because I love that car so much, but I didn't make enough money to properly,
maintain it
and drive.
It was pretty nice. Do you remember, like, we would go out to lunch and, like, we'd go to, like, China Camp or something, and it had that AM push button radio in it, and we'd listen to 960 cable, K-A-B-L.
Yeah.
That was so cool.
That was Perry Como with Magic Moments.
Yeah, that was so cool. That was, like,
such a great
driving
car.
In that car. It was like being in a time machine. And do you remember that one night we were, you had that studio for a while in San Francisco, and it was, like, down, like, sort of south of, I can't remember what that neighborhood's called, but, like, south of where the ballpark is now, like, across that bridge.
Yeah. Do you remember we were... I'm forgetting the name, too, but it's the old military base.
And we were driving. We'd been down there, and, like, I don't know, we were just, like, drinking or goofing off or whatever. And we were driving back in your Lincoln, and we were going across that steel gate bridge that's right by the stadium now. It was before they built this Pac Bell Park or whatever the hell it's called.
That's right. I remember
and that
this
dude,
now.
Like, hit the railing in an SUV, and it flipped, like, end over end and landed, like, upside down. And we were the only people there. And we
that's
were both
right.
like, I think we were in an altered state of mind, if memory serves.
Yeah,
and we were like, what? But we both, like, you pulled over and we ran over to the car, and the guy, he was okay. He was in his seatbelt still. And he, like, but he was, like, clearly, like, freaked out. But it turned out that he was like,
he had a seizure, right?
Yeah, he had some kind of like a handicap plate. So he had some kind of disability, and he'd had a seizure, and he couldn't speak correctly. And so he he stammered or something.
Right.
And I remember I ran over to the little house that was part of the bridge that would raise and lower the bridge.
Yeah, the gatehouse or whatever.
Yeah. And there was a dude in there, and I was like, call the cops or, you know, call an ambulance or whatever it was. And I remember there was stuff that flew out of his car when it flipped over. And one of the things was it landed, like, standing straight up, like, on its edge in the steel gate bridge. And it was a postcard of a Vermeer painting. It was the portrait of a lady writing. And I should have put it back in his car, but I took it. I still have it. It's on my refrigerator.
Oh, man.
That was the craziest
totally
night.
About that.
That one stuck out in my mind in a big way because it was just so, it was so bonkers.
Yeah, that was a really stressful event. It was really surreal. And yeah, you and I were in an altered state, and it was like, is this really happening? And
Because it was like, he hit the edge of the bridge and it caught, like, his, because I mean, it has a high, like, edge on it, and there's, like, a sidewalk and stuff too, but, like, it's a really weird bridge that, like, it tilts up so that boats can go into the, like, the inlet part of the bay where they can, like, you know, unload their, you know,
right,
whatever.
Well, and after the sidewalk there's those big beams that kind of go up at an angle, so
right,
seems like maybe he like drove up that, and that caused the car to flip over or something. That was
so crazy. Yeah. That was so freaky. And then you also had the coolest pickup. That was like an old, what was that one? That one was so awesome.
That was a 65 Dodge D200, I think it was.
And that was in mint condition too. It was like, it was so pristine. I remember, like, the exterior was really clean, had a great paint job. And, like, I think the interior was pretty, it had been refurbished too, hadn't it?
I think it was all original. I got really lucky with that because I don't know if you remember, but my mom at the time lived in Lakeport.
Right.
And her neighbor across the street was the original owner. It's like, oh, you know, George is selling his pickup because he just bought a new one. It's like this pristine 1965 Dodge. And I bought it from him.
That
directly.
Thing was so killer. That was a sweet pickup.
That was really nice. Yeah, I still like vintage cars. In fact, I have currently, even though I'm living in Vancouver, I had last year bought a 67 Dodge van in Colorado that I flew to Colorado to drive it back to my sister's house in Yucca Valley. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other story, but
is that the Dodge van that has, like, the headlights sort of look like cat's eyes, kind of like they have that weird, is that?
You might be thinking of the Ford Econoline where they
sort
of, like,
probably right.
Pinch
but they're
off.
Pointed. Yeah. At one edge. Yeah.
Yeah. But similar, like, at the time, the American car manufacturers were competing with, you know, Volkswagen. And so they were doing this sort of cab-forward design. So in my van, the 67 Dodge, there's a V8 engine that is sitting between the two front seats.
And that probably smells good, right? It smells just like gasoline all the time.
It smells like gasoline, and this, like, metal box gets super hot. So you're, like, driving, you can't even rest your arms. Like, damn. This is not safe.
That's cool. And are you sitting like, so you must be like right up front then. So your like legs are, your knees are the brakes, right? Like,
yeah, it's like collision. Fred Flintstone. This is like Ralph Nader, you know, freaking out. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's just not safe at all.
Yeah, that's so cool. That was always like, that was always something that was really fun in that period of time was you could get these really cool, I mean, you still can, but they're so much more expensive now, but you could get these cool old cars, especially in California, because nothing would rust, you know, it would like last forever.
But you had that cool Saab too. We called it the clown car, I think.
Yeah. I had a 1969 Saab 96 and it had what they called four on the tree. So it had the stick shift. It was a manual transmission. It had a V4 in it, and it had a stick shift that you would, you know, go first, second, third, fourth on the steering column. And I remember I bought it, and I took it to a Saab mechanic that was over in Berkeley, actually. It was B&B Saab, and he was the guy who did all the work on it. And I remember he looked at it, and he's like, oh, you bought one of these, huh? And I was like, yeah. And he's like, you know, we always used to say this is what a fart would look like if you could see one. And I was like, okay, cool.
Damn. Thanks, buddy.
But, you know, I love that car. That thing was so awesome. That was really fun.
That thing was so awesome. And then you did a really cool film project with Russell Earle on the Richmond Bridge, was it? Do you remember that?
I did? I don't remember that at all. I don't, actually. Did we?
I thought we shot film on your
on the 16.
On the 16, and it was Russell Earle driving the car. And I was in the follow car, and it was basically just getting shots of him driving across the bridge. And I can't remember. don't remember that.
I probably never did anything with that. That was like one of those things where like, if I always tell my students, right? Like, so now I teach, right? I have all these young students I work with, but I teach a class every other semester. That's just kind of a fun elective class. It's called Cutscene.
Yeah.
And in the class, like I have students make like short films, but using just off the shelf tools. So they're using like their smartphones and like different apps they can download. And the goal is to have them spend little or no money, right? And make high production value short movies. And they write their own stories and they act in each other's things and they help each other out, whatever. But I always think like, if I had had some of those tools back when we were like younger, like God, the things you could do. And what's crazy is it was so complicated and expensive to shoot film and process film. Like, it cost so much money. And it's like, even making like good money at ILM, it was like pulling something like that off. Just, it never quite seemed totally doable. But I think I look at students now and I think like, God, they you could do so much with your phone. Like, and it looks so cool. But what's weird is they don't do it.
They don't.
I'm not sure why, but maybe because it's like, you take it for granted because it's like ubiquitous, you know?
It's too accessible. I do remember some filmmakers that we worked with that the early days of ILM was like just having access, like if you knew the right person that could cut on the Avid for you or something like that.
I mean, me and Ty Ellingson did a couple of music videos and stuff. And then I mean, like Scott Balsarek did a lot of stuff. And then Amanda McKaylee, right? She did that amazing documentary, the Rodeo documentary.
Right.
That was so good. I remember watching that in the D screening room.
Just for the Ride?
And it was on like, it was on PBS, I think, too. Like, that was a great film.
It was amazing. Yeah. And, you know, Scott's film that he was doing at the time that you worked on.
Satan and Adam. Yeah. Finally came out.
You did.
Yeah. 20 some odd years later.
Do you remember you had a project that I was wanting to help you with, and I did a little bit at the time, but it called Manikid.
Yeah, with those crazy weird like 1950s or 60s mannequin, like little kid mannequins that were at that, what was that place called in the Mission that had?
It was a clothing store in the Mission District, but it was like
Dickies
frozen
and
in time.
Suits and like, it was so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to do the soundtrack. I had all these like ideas for guitar and slide guitar.
I have the footage from that on the 16 millimeter negative in my office at work.
I think we did one shot where it was like, so we did a lot of footage, or you did a lot of footage in that clothing store. But then there was once where I think we got on a Muni bus in San Francisco.
We took one of them on a bus.
with this mannequin that you talked the store owners like, hey, can I take your 1940s child mannequin
right
out of your shop window and onto a Muni bus to shoot some film?
I remember that guy, he got really angry with me at one point. Like, and he was asking, I brought everything back and nothing was broken. Everything was fine. But I remember he was like demanding money from me. And I was like, I don't have any money to give you. Like, I don't know.
I wonder if he thought like, oh, I'm going to get some great publicity from the Star Wars company or something.
Maybe. I don't know. But, so
it's like no.
crazy tangent. So you do the coffee truck for a while. That doesn't pan out, I gather.
Yeah. Well, here's what happened. So I essentially built this truck myself, and mm-hmm. that for me was the therapy. You know, I spent, I don't know how much time, maybe 6 months.
Yeah. Doing something physical. Yeah.
Yeah. Just figuring out how to power an espresso machine from New Zealand on a truck with a generator and got it operational. And then I remember being in the trucks somewhere in San Diego at a beach, like, how many cups of coffee do I need to sell to pay my rent kind of thing? It's like, this isn't really what I want to be doing. So I was very fortunate in that I was able to sell the company, sell the truck, and kind of recoup my expenses. Mm-hmm. And then for a short time lived in Joshua Tree. I moved to Joshua Tree and
I love it there. That's like, I used to go there all the time in high school growing up. Like we'd go out there, my friends and I, my dad had a house in Palm Desert, which you've been there with Mike.
Yeah. Mike Paul.
Yeah. When we went out there, I still have some awesome photographs from our extended stay in Palm Desert and Joshua Tree, but that's so cool. Like, so what took you there? Was it your...
I think it was just kind of part of that, like part of the midlife crisis and change that, you know, I'd left New Zealand.
Did you rent an apartment or a house there or something?
I rented a small house and I had been living in San Diego, but you know, once I sold the coffee truck and that business, I was able to rent a house in Joshua Tree for half the price I was, you know, renting in San Diego.
That's so cool.
And kind of buy myself some time and figure out what the next step was. Mm-hmm. And
how long were you there for?
I think it was slightly less than a year. And that's kind of when ILM Vancouver came on my radar and I got a lighting TD position at ILM Vancouver and decided to get back into visual effects.
Huh, that's cool. And are you still at ILM now?
No, I left ILM probably around this time last year. Mm-hmm. And for about the last year, I've been working with a startup virtual production company.
Oh, wow.
As kind of heading up their R&D department. And the company's based in China, but they're starting a new studio here in Vancouver.
And that's so cool.
Kind of building up a team. I've got about, you know, 8 really solid people and just kind of doing R&D on more real time, focusing on kind of creature work. And,
are you working in Unreal a lot then?
Yeah. Working in Unreal and really just investigating, you know, how do we approach film quality, creature results in this real time engine? And it's pretty amazing because if you look at Epic Games, you know, you'd see a lot of guys that used to work at ILM in the creatures department and of course Kim Librari.
Sure.
And so it's pretty exciting how that stuff is evolving and how a lot of the off the shelf stuff is just really incredible.
One, was it Weta? I can't remember now who did that piece with the meerkat.
Yeah, that was Weta.
Yeah. And that's got some like real time rendered hair and fur systems going on. And I mean, it's quite an impressive demo, and I think they put that in there. Didn't they put that? They put that in their latest point release, right? Some of those assets.
They did, yeah. I think that entire project is available to download for anyone. That Meerkat project.
That's cool. So, and this company that you're working with now, like, are you gonna like for the foreseeable future? That's kind of your jam.
I think so. Yeah. I'm definitely, it's been a really great experience to to kind of shift focus and look at this real-time production pipeline and how can we approach film quality creature results like creature deformations and renders and, you know, everything. And it's there's some really exciting things going on, especially with facial performance and different ways that things like machine learning are you know, playing into that. And
it does feel like this real-time rendered sort of virtual production universe, it feels like it's the first really like sort of big breakthrough, like new kind of too many cliches, but like paradigm shifting kind of technological breakthrough that it could really change the way we think about and approach solutions in visual effects.
I think you're right. I mean, I think it essentially is flipping the traditional visual effects pipeline on its head. And, you know, at least in relation to creature work, what used to be considered post-production is now pre-production. So a lot of this sort of asset preparation and hair, cloth, skin, muscle simulation can all take place up front in the pre-production phase, so that when, you know, in a virtual production context, when you're on set and you've got, you know, a camera and a guy in a suit, motion capture, driving a character, that you're going to see in real time the same kind of results that you might see, you know, back in the day after things had run overnight, you know, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cranking away on CPUs. So
it changes like the whole, like, yeah, it flips everything on its head. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's pretty exciting. I think you're right. It does represent a big change, whereas people have sort of been cooking along for a while on the old traditional VFX pipeline.
And to be able to have witnessed so much of that evolution too is really pretty cool.
It is. Yeah. To think back at, like, you know, we could walk into D building, into editorial. And like, I remember walking past, like, remember Tim Gleason, one of the editors?
Totally.
There?
Yeah.
So he'd be at that, you might know what it's called, but whatever, that machine where you kind of wind through and cut film. And
yeah, and, like on the Steenbeck, the flatbed.
Yeah. And so he had this handwritten note taped on the wall above his workstation. And it was something that George Lucas had written. And it was like, all ships must exit frame or something. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy.
That's so cool. Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for coming on and talking to me, but we're going to have to pick it up there next week.
Okay.
It's so great talking with you. And I think it's really cool hearing, you know, your whole trajectory from philosophy major at Berkeley, a useless degree, to the future of visual effects. No, it's really cool. And like, I think that, you know, it just speaks volumes to, like, I think you as a person, like, you're so, you know, affable and like such a, like, you know, clearly like so, just so smart about, like, you know, the way you've moved through your own career. It's really inspiring to hear. It's really cool.
Well, thank you, Matt. You know, I really appreciate that. Yeah, I'm honored that you wanted to have me on the show. I think it's so cool. And
oh, sorry, I dozed off there.
I dozed off remote there.
No, next time we talk though, man, we got to figure out how to do this in person so like we can like actually have real time cocktails live.
Yes.
In the flesh, because that would be so much more fun. I mean, not that this isn't fun or anything, but you know. Come on.
Oh, yeah. No, this is not. I do have a really great cocktail bar on my balcony here in Vancouver, so you have to come visit. And
it's a deal, man. Once we're all vaccinated.
That's right.
Or when we're all dead and we're zombies. I don't know. Either one. It's cool.
Either one. We'll make it work.
All right, dude. Great talking with you, man.
You too, Matt. Cheers. Thank you very much.